The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Philadelphia and South Jersey, welcome to Inside Medicine. I have a fantastic guest on today, Dr. Mark Fisher, who is a rheumatologist who's been on before, and I've requested him come back because he just gives a tremendous one-hour indication of what's everything's going on in rheumatology. But just let me start out 1 second for an intro. In life, you must identify your goals. You must adopt a strategy to win. What is your strategy? Do you have a strategy to stay alive? Why do patients come to the doctor's office? Let me just introduce you to a dynamic rheumatologist, Dr. Mark Fisher. He's an excellent internist. He's been in business a long time, a tremendously official office, and I'm just happy to have Mark on again. Let me just introduce Mark. Mark is a rheumatologist for many years. He's at Haddon Heights, New Jersey. He's got a phone number of 856-547-8004. He is a fellow of the American College of Rheumatology. He is a graduate of Hahnemann Medical College, internal medicine in Hahnemann, and a fellowship at Temple University in rheumatology. He's board certified. He's got a subspecialty in rheumatology, clinical densitometry. He practices out of Our Lady Lourdes Hospital and his office at 713 Station Avenue, Haddon Heights, New Jersey. And he does have his own infusion center, is an expert on osteoporosis. Mark, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Thank you so much, Joe. Good morning. It's very, very nice to be back on your show again.
I love having you on, Mark. So let me just ask, what kind of conditions do a rheumatologist treat? Because you've got more than 10, for sure. So you run out of fingers.
That's why I use my feet to count as well, Joe. So rheumatology is a relatively new subspecialty. It's only been around since, it started in the 1940s, 1950s, and in 1950s, that's when prednisone was first developed. And rheumatologists blossomed over the last 5 or 6 decades, especially over these last few decades when so many new, fantastic drugs have come onto the market that have given such substantial help in improving the quality of life in so many patients. So these disorders, Joe, really involve muscles, joints, tendons, bursa sacs, all the different forms of the connective tissues in our bodies. So it has involvement of various kinds of different arthritis disorders. The most common one that we see is something called osteoarthritis. And this is the form of arthritis that comes with wear and tear and gets worse and worse over age, or also is a complication of patients that have previous injuries to their joints. Then there are other more what we call inflammatory or autoimmune type conditions. These conditions are typified by something like rheumatoid arthritis. And this is where the body begins to form antibodies against our own tissues. And that's an abnormal situation. So here is where you get severe, intense inflammation. It can involve many different joints, the small joints like the fingers, in both hands, the wrist joints, the feet, and larger joints like the shoulders, the knees, the hip joints. And if this is untreated, as has been the case for centuries, and that is no longer the case over the last 30 years, of course, you get severe impairment of functionality because of destruction of these joints. Patients become immobile, disabled, and wind up needing joint replacements if such are available for the person. And
Mark,
hopefully nowadays... Yes.
Mark, can you just clarify? You said antibodies. Can you help our audience out? What are antibodies, and what are they? How are they causing destruction of, say, a joint?
Absolutely, Joe. So what we have our proteins in our bodies, which make up our constitution. We have different kinds of substances, chemical substances that form the whole chemistry network of our body. Now, sometimes if we get an infection, say a virus or bacteria, our body has what we call immunoglobulins, and these are the proteins in our blood which form antibodies which counteract and destroy these offending proteins like a virus or a bacteria. Now, our own systems have what we call tolerance, and that means that we do not damage our own systems from our within our cells. But sometimes a patient may have a genetic disorder in which that tolerance breaks down. As a result, these antibodies or proteins are directed against our own body and causes damage, and it sets up very intense inflammation. So that when this antibody, this protein directed against our own body to attack it, attacks those proteins it's directed against, it sets up a very intense inflammatory type of reaction. And when that occurs, it then stimulates many other inflammatory substances to develop and get released into the body and cause severe inflammation. That's why sometimes we get hives, we get skin rashes, we may get swelling of the joints from the very intense inflammation that may occur. And then we take medication, try to suppress that inflammation, and by suppressing that inflammation that does occur, it reduces the risk of damage. But the consequence, the complication of this damage is destruction of those tissues. In the case of the skin, it has a very severe rash, like psoriasis, for example. Or in the case of the joint, it causes severe pain, redness, swelling, fluid developed, and these release other chemical substances into the joint, which causes severe damage to the cartilage, erosions and damage into the bone, and this causes severe dysfunction because now that joint can no longer function normally. Now, this could also, at the same time, not only affect the skin, not only affect the joint, but it could also affect other organs in our body, like the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the gastrointestinal tract, the brain, the nerves in our body. And as a consequence of that, it causes lack of proper normal functioning in these organs as well, and that causes chronic disease states.
So, Mark, let me ask you this. Is that why rheumatologists sometimes turn the back of their hand over and say put it over a knee or a body area to see if there's any warmth, which would indicate, I guess, that the body is mad at that particular area for some reason?
Yeah, more or less, that's a good way to put it, Joe, yes. So that's why some of the early signs of inflammation is that you get increased blood flow there because the body's natural reaction to an insult or an offensive action where you get some kind of attack to its tissues is you can bring more blood flow there to try to heal it, to bring substances in there to quiet down the inflammation, and that creates this warmth. And by putting over the back of the hand over the particular joint, you can feel a difference in temperature. You feel that warmth, which indicates the inflammation, the increased blood flow that is occurring. And then the other manifestation, like I was saying, is that in addition to the warmth, which indicates this inflammation increasing blood flow to try to help the body protect itself against this severe offense, this severe attack that is occurring, then you get the release of many other anti-inflammatory substances as well to help the body fight off this attack, just like it does when we have an infection like bacteria or a virus or yeast infections, for example. But this is not due to infection. This inflammation is due to an attack on the body's own defense mechanisms from within itself.
So, Mark, what about gout? Because that generates heat, doesn't it, at certain sites? Does gout, how can a rheumatologist kind of like quickly assess that there is a potential for gout issue, which usually, I think, gets the guys over the gals in numbers?
Well, that's absolutely right. So probably 90% of gout patients are men. And that affects men usually in the younger ages, maybe 30s to 40s. And women don't really seem, it's very rare for women to have that. They don't seem to get the attack at that time. However, when we get older, then there's almost an equal distribution between men and women because of other disease processes that may occur. So that different problems may occur within the body, which leads to an overproduction of uric acid. And uric acid is a natural byproduct of metabolism in our body of genetic material, what we call nucleic acids. And the end product of that metabolism is the production of uric acid. And some people do have a genetic disorder in which there is an overproduction of this uric acid and a lack of breakdown of it. Now, we all have seen the birds fly by our windows, and we see the white soot that gets on the window, and that's the byproduct of the metabolism in the bird, and that's the uric acid right there. But that's what we're getting in our own joints, so that we can develop severe, intense inflammation. Probably, Joe, gout is one of the most intensely inflammatory related arthritic disorders that there may be. You get very intense redness, intense pain, intense swelling from this particular type of inflammation. As a matter of fact,
Mark,
you might see a patient just overnight dramatically goes to bed fine, and in the morning cannot walk.
Got it. So if you look under the microscope, you guys sometimes stick a needle in, and which I guess is challenging for the patient and you. What do you see under the microscope? What does gout look like?
Well, there are very, very specific findings here. There are a couple of different findings that we look for here. And it's very, like you pointed out, Joe, actually, it's very, very important. The most important diagnostic tool that we have to make the proper diagnosis is not with a blood test. A blood test is really never the way to make this diagnosis. A lot of times, physicians may require the patient to have a blood test done, checking the level of the uric acid. And that's very important. And helps us mostly to try to manage and treat the condition, but it is not the diagnostic tool that is most important. The most important diagnostic tool in trying to assess and make this diagnosis properly and correctly is by aspirating the joint and obtaining the fluid that is the result of this severe, intense inflammation. Now, once we get the fluid out of the joint, then we do, as you said, put it under the microscope. And we look for two different things. One is we ask the laboratory to tell us what is the white blood corpuscle count? What is the white blood cell count in this fluid? Because by doing that, that will define for us right away, immediately, if there is inflammation. By knowing the count of the white blood cells in that joint fluid, that tells us that there is intense inflammation. And very often, patients with this type of severe, acute, gouty inflammation will have a white blood cell count of 20, 30, 40,000, and that is extremely high. And that defines for us there is inflammation. The second most important thing to diagnose more specifically that this is gout is we put it under a special microscope we call the polarizing microscope. And we put a little drop of fluid in a slide, we put it under the microscope, and we look for different forms of abnormalities. And what it is, we find these crystals. And this crystal that causes gout, the sodium urate crystal, is a long needle-shaped appearing crystal. And that is the form, that is the shape of it. Now, very importantly, we now use the characteristics of the polarizing microscope, and we can rotate the slide. And when the slide is parallel to the plane of light under the microscope, it is yellow in color. And when we turn the slide so it's perpendicular to the plane of light, it's now blue in color. This characterizes for us very specifically and very definitively that this is a sodium urate crystal. And we have now very simply, very clearly, and very quickly now defined and confirmed this patient has acute gouty arthritis.
Gotcha. Okay, so the gout guys are hitting joints and toes. I think there's this always thing about you can't put a blanket or a sheet over your foot if you have a gouty attack. I think the guy from Philadelphia years ago who was well known, he was a gout guy. But how do you treat gout?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to treat gout, Joe. First of all, we can use an old line medicine been around for 100 years. It's called colchicine. Colchicine is a tiny pill, which is very effective in trying to relieve inflammation from gout. However, the downside of this, Joe, is that traditionally you'll give a pill of colchicine to someone, like two right away, then every hour you repeat another dose until the patient feels better. Or, unfortunately, the patient will suffer the severe consequences of the adverse reaction of this pill. So although it can be very effective in reducing the acute, severe, intense inflammation of a gouty arthritis attack, which is severely painful for the person, and like you said, they can't even put a sheet over the foot, they cannot put any weight on the foot, but then they start developing nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and that makes the pill intolerable at that point. And especially we have some of our older folks that give where their hemodynamic, their cardiovascular status might be more impaired. To give someone this type of problem, diarrhea and vomiting, and this kind of fluid loss, that could be very, very critically important to threatening their health, and they can wind up in the emergency room or in the hospital intravenous fluids. So that could be kind of risky and dangerous to this particular individual. So now what we do is we use other drugs. We can use the colchicine, but if that doesn't do the trick, we can use a group of drugs called NSAIDs, non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs. And these can be very potent, very intense in reducing inflammation. And some of the common drugs in this category would be something like indomethacin, ibuprofen, and a whole slew of other drugs, naproxen, in this category. These drugs have been around, like ibuprofen or Motrin came around 1974. Over the last 40 years, many other anti-inflammatory drugs have come along on the marketplace to help treat these kind of conditions. Now, even though they can be very helpful, Joe, they have a lot of substantial risk of side effects. All drugs have risk of side effects. Every drug has potential adverse reactions. So we must be very keenly aware of all of this. Now, these drugs, even though they can be very helpful and very effective in trying to reduce and treat acute inflammation like this, and that can make a marked difference in acute and quicker recovery of a patient from such acute gouty inflammation, we must be very, very keenly aware of the potential adverse reactions. The first most important one we have to be aware of would be on the GI tract. And these can cause acute indigestion and nausea, and more importantly, erosions or even bleeding ulcers in the stomach, which could be catastrophic for a person if not handled properly. So as a result, what I do as a preventive tool, I always will treat a person with such an anti-inflammatory, and at the same time, I give them a medicine to suppress acid in the stomach. For example, Pepcid or famotidine, which is the generic name, will reduce acid, or other drugs are called proton pump inhibitors, PPI for short, and such drugs as Prilosec or Omeprazole, which is the generic name, is even more potent than the Pepcid in trying to reduce acid, and that makes the tolerance of the medicine much better, and it greatly can reduce the risk of having any stomach issues. But Joe, there are other very important risk of side effects from these NSAID drugs, which we also must be keenly aware as physicians, and patients should also be self-educated and being aware of these things too. And that is, it can cause fluid retention, and otherwise, very important, it can cause potential kidney damage and also increase risk of cardiovascular problems like stroke and heart attack. Now, usually these situations are most importantly seen in patients that do have pre-existing kidney problems or pre-existing heart issues or history of stroke in the past. So it's very rare to see such problems in the normal individual that don't have pre-existing disease. But where it does exist with chronic kidney problems or history of cardiovascular disease, we must be very, very cautious in the use of these drugs. So these drugs in those situations can potentially greatly accelerate such other complications or these particular problems the patient may be suffering from already. Now, so
Mark,
once
I guess
we
what you're
surpass...
saying is, Mark, yes. Can I just hop in? So what you're saying is there are certain these side effects, like if somebody's got a bad heart, they may retain a lot of fluid from these NSAIDs. But overall, you would say that they're a pretty safe drug because they're sold everywhere and sold everywhere, so they have to be overall not a disaster in terms of risk. Your take on
that? That is correct, Jared. That's absolutely right, and they're very effective. However, like I said, where someone has some other existing underlying diseases like kidney disease, heart disease, stroke history, history of esophagitis, acid reflux, peptic ulcer, then we must be that much more cautious in the use of such drugs. But in the general population of people, they can be very effective and reasonably safe, keeping in mind all these different cautions that we definitely should exercise.
So, Mark, let's just move forward. I think you did a great job on that gout and that inflammation and the concept. What about people who come to you and complain about muscles? So not joints this time, it's painful muscles. How does a rheumatologist deal with that complaint?
Now, like I said in the outset, all the different parts of our connective tissues are very important in dealing with different rheumatology-related disorders. And there's certain disorders, Joe, where the joint and arthritis per se is really not the real crux of the problem. People may have some stiffness and soreness in the muscles, what we call myalgias, and they're very achy, and they think they have arthritis, but indeed it's really a muscle-related problem and not arthritis per se, but it's still a systemic inflammatory condition. And when I teach residents, when they come over from Rowan, my office, for their rotation for experience in rheumatology, I try to point out to them that there are three major categories of this that we should be really keenly aware. There's a condition we call fibromyalgia, which is a condition where there's very severe, intense stiffness and soreness in muscles, and that can affect all different muscle groups all over the body, the neck, the back, shoulders, arms, upper arms, lower arms, hip areas, upper legs, lower legs. And most importantly, they have severe pain, but if the pain was not there, you would not really feel weak. A lot of people may come into the doctor's office and say, I'm weak, I can't do anything, but it's really the pain that prevents them from doing anything. So that's all we have to, at this point now, say, well, what is causing this problem? And we know that there's a great, great overlap in different kinds of connective tissue disorders and autoimmune disorders, which can cause similar symptoms. So it's very important for the physician to take a complete history and do appropriate testing for the patient to try and make a defined diagnosis so the proper management of the patient can be entertained. Now, a patient that has fibromyalgia can have other associated symptoms, such as a feeling of weakness, but it's really not weakness, it's more profound tiredness, fatigue, what we call malaise. And that can interfere with their proper cognitive function. It can make them feel depressed because they can't do anything. It disturbs their sleep patterns. And as disorders their sleep patterns, it makes cognitive function worse, fatigue worse, and their pain worse. And they find that they have very poor function. It's hard to work. It's hard to do their activities at home. It's hard to exercise. So it's very important to do further laboratory testing for that person to make sure some other disorder is not causing this particular problem. Because other patients can have some stiffness and soreness in the muscles. And the pain there is not the dramatic change, Joe. The pain there is mild, but in this case, the person may actually have profound weakness. They can't literally get up out of the chair because not of pain, but because they don't have the strength. They don't have the power. They can't brush their hair. They can't shampoo their hair. They can't put their clothes on because they're too weak. Not because of the pain, but they're too weak. And this kind of individual, unlike the fibromyalgia patient, will have abnormal laboratory studies. The fibromyalgia patient typically has normal laboratory testing. But the patient with this condition we call polymyositis. And that is a very intense autoimmune disorder, we turn on our bodies and have antibodies attacking our own muscle tissues. And this causes destruction and damage of our muscle fibers in our arms and our legs. And it makes it very, very difficult to have any movement and to have any power in these muscles. And that can be very progressive. And such patients can be wheelchair bound. But on the other hand, Joe, they can be helped. There is extremely effective treatment to combat this condition, get this severe inflammation under good control, and these persons can then develop and function in a normal way. But we have to have early diagnosis, which includes blood testing, it includes doing a certain tests we call EMG, electromyography, which they put little pins in the muscles and they have electrical impulse we can assess to see if this shows a pattern of muscle damage. Then finally, we find high muscle enzymes in the blood testing, and ultimately we'll do a muscle biopsy on one of these affected muscles, which is the definitive way of seeing damage, and we know now to treat the person with the appropriate medications. And then,
so Mark,
lastly,
when that patient,
yes.
Mark, when that patient comes to you, how do you make a diagnosis real quick? I mean, do they have to do a squat and then they can't do, or how do you make that diagnosis of muscle insufficiency?
What I find is that it's very important to have the complete, very important, complete history of the person, because that alone will oftentimes give the diagnosis, as most things are in medicine these days. So it hasn't really moved away, a far way from the century since Hippocrates was here. We just have a lot of fancy techno things we can do, but still the history. We find that the proximal muscle, that is the muscle around the shoulder areas, the muscles around the hip areas are very weak, but yet the hand grip is strong, or the strength around the ankles are strong, because this affects more of what we call the proximal muscles. And also people may have difficulty swallowing because the muscles in the esophagus, our swallowing tube, are affected as well. So a patient may say, no, doc, it's very hard to swallow. Or I get a lot of heartburn because those muscles are weak. Or they might have some double vision because, after all, our eyes focus because they're muscles around the eyes that control the eye movements. That's why we can look in the mirror and see our eyes go up and down from side to side. But those muscles get weak too, and therefore we might have blurred vision or double vision. So this whole pattern of weakness and these other associated symptoms which give us the important clinical clues. And then right away, we would then go ahead and get some testing done, like I was alluding to earlier, and get a muscle enzyme panel to see if these enzymes are very high, and that's typically the case with patients with such conditions. Then once we have these kinds of information available to us, then we can get the other more sophisticated type studies, like this EMG electromyogram that I mentioned, and also the muscle biopsy where it's indicated. And it's very important to do these things very quickly, and once I see with my exam, and even the abnormal muscle testing I do in the office in this way, and just like you say, getting up from a chair or getting up from a stoop position, they find they cannot do this. This is very important information to make that clinical diagnosis of the distribution of where the weakness occurs. Then a quick blood test, getting a, what we call CPK and aldolase. These are names of these enzymes I'll get, which indicate muscle inflammation. Then right away, I'll start them on therapy like high doses of steroid medicine. In the meantime, of course, I had the patient quickly get this EMG test and see a surgeon, get the muscle biopsy to help confirm this diagnosis on the one hand. And secondly, and very importantly now, muscle biopsy doesn't only confirm the diagnosis, Joe. It also gives us an idea of how badly the patient is getting along, because the biopsy may show intense inflammation, and that tells us the patient has a good prognosis if a lot of good muscle fiber is there. But if the muscle biopsy shows a lot of degeneration, destruction of the muscle, a lot of fatty replacement of muscle, then we know that muscle is never coming back because there's no muscle fiber remaining. So it gives a lot of information, just not only for the confirmation of the current diagnosis, but also for the prognosis on what the recovery prospects will be for that particular person.
So, Mark, how do you play this? Because you've got a patient here who's got severe proximal weakness, probably needed help getting into your office. Do you ever give, like, you can tell me this is the wrong thing to do, give a test challenge of a high-dose prednisone and see how they respond, or is that the wrong way to play that disease?
Well, I think, like I was saying, there are other kinds of conditions that can give weakness. People get damaged nerves from diabetes, for example. There's a lot of other conditions. So I think it's important to do things not only sequentially, but simultaneously. So to try and do things properly, so we know what we are really truly dealing with, I think in that situation, it's very important to quickly send the patient to a lab immediately, get the blood work done so we have a better idea that there's signs of a sedimentation rate, for example, or C-reactive protein. These are two testing measures which tell us that there's severe systemic inflammation. that we get the CPK, the muscle enzymes, done. And when these are very high, then yes, that same week I will immediately, as you were saying, start with high dosage of steroids. So this is critical to try and treat the intense inflammation and reduce the risk of more and more muscle damage, which we, if we don't do that quickly, then we take the chance of that person getting worse and worse muscle damage and having their prognosis and chance of full recovery being impaired as well. So it's important to get on this immediately and then take longer time to get the other more sophisticated testing done, like the EMG test I alluded to and the muscle biopsy. But do not delay getting all these other fancy tests done. Like you're saying, let's get started right away to salvage the muscles, prevent a worse prognosis, and have a full recovery that person can enjoy then a very normal life.
Mark, you are a professor. That's all we can say. Get it done right the first time.
Exactly right.
So let's see here. Can you give us any other, are there any other rheumatoid diseases that you take care of? Because you're an A to Z guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Joe. Because in line with, just to complete for the listening audience so they understand this too, especially in the older individual that's over 50 or 60 years of age, they can have also severe, intense muscle pain. So they're, it's kind of like the fibromyalgia patient I was talking about, Joe. They can present to you with complaints of feeling weak because in their case, not that the muscles are weak and damaged, but because the pain impairs them from moving, just like the fibromyalgia patient. But differently here is they have a distribution of pain in these proximal muscles, like the patient with the muscle weakness and polymyositis. Now, this person comes with severe pain. They lose their appetite. They lose weight. Then they have fever. And they literally have such profound fatigue and pain they cannot function at all. They come to you, and a lot of times they are tend to be an older individual. And just the description of their symptoms and the impairment they have in this proximal upper arm muscle areas and the upper hip area, those thigh muscles, are the ones that are mostly impaired. So therefore, we do here suspect this condition we call polymyalgia rheumatica. And the importance of this is that not only does it impair people, and it's extremely treatable, and patients can be put on low doses of prednisone, not the high doses of polymyositis patient had, but just low doses of prednisone, up to 20 milligrams per day. And within a week, it makes a dramatic, dramatic reversal in their symptoms. But the other important part with this person is that not only do we have to be aware of this, of the intense inflammation they have, the high inflammatory markers like sedimentation rate and C-reactive protein, and this and the very beautiful response they have very quickly to low dose of steroids, but there's a very high association with a condition we call temporal arteritis or giant cell arteritis. And the importance of this, Joe, is that if we miss this diagnosis of inflammation in the arteries, particularly involving the head, that can lead to a sudden onset of blindness because the arteries to the optic nerve are impaired. And this could be a permanent complication of this condition. And in this case, that's why it's so, so important to start the steroids in this person right away. The difference here is that they have the arteritis complication. They do require very high dose of the prednisone, potential risk of a lot of side effects, as opposed to the low dose of steroid needed for people with uncomplicated polymyalgia rheumatica. So it's very, very important to recognize these potential issues, recognize the existence of these conditions, and get the diagnosis right quickly and get the personal treatment quickly as well.
So that that disease you were talking about, where would a patient feel if they palpated their own body? Where would they feel that? You know, we talked about knees and hips and all that, but where would they feel that CNS problem that would be a disaster to miss?
Okay, well, this tenderness you would find would be in the upper neck muscles, the shoulder, the upper arms, biceps areas, and the lower and around the hip areas and the thigh muscles are very tender. Now, what's very important is they had this potential complication of the temporal arteritis or giant cell arteritis with these potential risk of serious complications like loss of vision. is that the patients may complain of three important things. One, they may have a very severe, intense headache, which won't go away. They may develop jaw pain. So as they're chewing or as they're speaking, they find they have a lot of achiness in their jaw area. And if they rest and stop chewing and stop speaking, the jaw pain may actually feel better. So we call this jaw claudication. Much like when someone has a severe arterial insufficiency in their legs and they walk and they have to stop walking because the circulation can't keep up with the muscle demands of the exercise. Same thing happens in the jaw here because of the inflammation in the arteries, it impairs the blood flow through the jaw muscles. And the third important thing, they may develop severe sudden onset of visual loss, even though it might be for seconds and it comes back. That is an emergency. It's one of the few rheumatological emergencies. And that is, someone complains to you that they have these pains that we described, they have a headache, perhaps jaw pain, and they tell you, you know, doc, I have this loss of vision, I couldn't see, and all of a sudden it came back very quickly, within seconds or a minute. That becomes emergency. I tell people, if that ever happens to you, don't even waste your time calling me. You go right to the emergency room and tell them that I'm treating you for polymyalgia rheumatica and that you need high-dose steroids. That's extremely, extremely, extremely important to do, and you can salvage, you can save that patient from permanent visual loss.
So, Mark, that's a tough call because, you know, if you send somebody to the ER, I mean, are they able to quickly do a temporal artery biopsy, and how do the patients respond when you tell them, I've got to take a piece of that artery up there, you know, little higher and anterior to the ear to make that temporal artery biopsy, you know, tell us the real story?
That's an important point, Joe. And first of all, such a biopsy is done under local anesthesia, and it's what we call an end artery. So in other words, by snipping a little piece of that artery, you don't lose anything. There's really nothing beyond it. It's done under local anesthesia, requires maybe two or three steri strips afterwards. So it's not a very involved procedure. But the other point I would make is that once this diagnosis, Joe, is suspected, and that someone, the physician in the emergency room or the primary care office or the rheumatology office suspects that this is acute onset of temporal arteritis with the potential risk of visual loss, we have confirmed with the high inflammatory blood test, which can be done quickly, then we do not hesitate. We do not delay. We do not defer treatment for anything like an artery biopsy. Immediately, we start treatment with high doses of steroids like prednisone, 60 or 80 milligrams per day, along with a stomach acid reducer, like I alluded to earlier, like the omeprazole or famotidine to reduce stomach complications. Now, once this is in process, then we arrange for the patient to have the temporal artery biopsy done. And if we have the biopsy done within the next 2 weeks, that will not really change the results of the biopsy to help us confirm this diagnosis. But because the problem is we call it a segmental disease, which means when we look at the artery, only a little portion of which are inflamed, other portion may look normal. So it's very easy for the surgeon to biopsy the artery as we asked, and make it like a centimeter, 2 centimeter portion of the artery, but perhaps the pathologist will miss the diagnosis because that portion of the artery may not have been involved, even though we know this person has this condition based on the symptoms, and based on the very high inflammatory markers. So even if the biopsy is negative, I never hesitate to continue treatment for this person. And like I said, I never hesitate to start my treatment, even though the biopsy is not yet done.
Got it. Important, important. So obviously, a good clinician pays. And Mark, I appreciate your explanation. It's fantastic. So basically, what you're saying is that you have a respect for prednisone, but there are certain conditions in your business that you just have to give a significant dose to make sure that there's no tissue damage. Did I sum that up okay?
That's absolutely correct. And realize it, and also discuss the patient, because all patients have a right to know potential risk of the treatment that you're offering them. And there's a lot of significant risk of side effects in the prednisone, but always with all treatment, whether we're treating diabetes or hypertension or heart disease or rheumatoid arthritis or other conditions, every single drug has risk of side effects. And we have to deal with the balance between the benefit to be derived from our treatment and the risk to the patient with the treatment. And as long as the benefit far outweighs the risk, it makes it a reasonable thing to do and take all the precaution we can as physicians and also for the patient to try to minimize the risk of these adverse effects happening to the patient.
So, Mark, you and your partners in rheumatology are experts in NSAIDs. Could you just give us a little small tutorial on your overall opinion for the audience on NSAIDs?
Yes, NSAIDs have a very important role in trying to manage patients with inflammatory diseases. Now, for a while, Joe, when we treated inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis or gout, for example, many years ago, we didn't have any nice anti-inflammatory agent other than prednisone, which, as I said in the beginning, started back in the 1950s. Then the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, other NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories came onto the marketplace, and these have made a huge difference in managing patients with inflammatory diseases. Now, we use drugs such as ibuprofen or another drug called meloxicam, the brand name is Mobic, or celecoxib, the brand name there is Celebrex. And these can be very, very potent in trying to reduce inflammation, but also, as I alluded to earlier in our conversation, they have potential risk of side effects like in the stomach, kidneys, heart, and we have to be aware of these kind of problems. Also, patients may be taking anticoagulants for their cardiovascular disease or because they have recurrent phlebitis and blood clots of various kinds of situations in that regard. Then, if you give NSAIDs, that can greatly increase the risk of bleeding and increase the risk of side effects, which are not to be acceptable for this patient. So that's why we must have a total picture of knowing all the medication a patient may take and all their other medical conditions. So if they have existing heart disease, they have existing kidney disease, do not want to treat patients with such medications. But in the absence of that, these can be very, very important therapeutic tools in trying to help inflammation with the patient. So for osteoarthritis and mild inflammatory condition, tendonitis, bursitis, neck and back pain, these can be very, very helpful therapeutic tools for the patient. Now, the other thing very importantly for all of us to remember is that in treating patients with inflammatory conditions, like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, while the NSAID medications can help the inflammation, help give the patient a little relief from their stiffness, their pain, it has absolutely, absolutely no impact on trying to save the joint, reduce the risk of damage to the joint. And that's where all of these other immune-related medicines come into play, medicines like methotrexate or the flutamide or azathioprine, these biologic agents people seen on TV like Enbrel and Remicade and a whole slew of other medicines like this, which have an absolute positive impact on trying to save the joint and give the person a more normal life and no offense to orthopedic colleagues that we have, but prevent them from having to see the orthopedic surgeon and getting joint replacements. So it's a whole combination of therapy that we have to exercise for our patients.
Mark, I got to give you a breath 1 second, but we'll get you going again. Now, let's flip topics here. And how about one of your favorites and one that you're fantastic at, osteoporosis? Do you want to tell us how you manage osteoporosis? And I guess there's a diagnostic maneuver in there too.
Absolutely, Joe. This is unfortunately one of the most misdiagnoses and undertreated conditions that we have. I can't tell you when we look at studies after studies how many patients wind up getting a fractured hip repaired, and then that's it until they fracture the next bone. And people don't necessarily always move forward in making the proper diagnosis and try to exercise preventive care in this case. So osteoporosis, as we get older, it's natural to lose bone mass. That's just the way it is. As our hormone levels drop, both in women, which occurs much earlier than in men, and that's why we see the development of osteoporosis much sooner in women starting in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and in men usually over 60s and 70s. But eventually then, men do catch up to this loss of bone mass called osteoporosis. The most important part of osteoporosis is that it increases risk of fracture with very minimal injury. We call this low fragility fracture. It doesn't make much of an injury because, after all, any severe injury, whether you're 10, 12 years old or 80 years old, you're going to get a fractured bone. But it's a very minimal injury which leads to a fracture in someone that has this osteoporosis or reduced bone mass condition. Not only is the bone mass reduced, and we can get a very nice diagnostic tool called a DEXA scan. And that's very easy to obtain. And the radiologist just needs a prescription from your primary care physician, your endocrinologist, your rheumatologist, or any of the other doctors you're seeing. And this test will give us an idea of what your bone mineral density is. And in doing this test, the radiologist or your physician can assess this test not only by looking at the bone mineral density, but also look at something called a T-score. Now, this T-score is a score which is an exponential number, and what it does, it compares your bone mineral density to the normal young population. And if there is a significant difference between your density and the normal density that should be expected, then that's how we help to define this person as having either osteopenia, which is mild bone loss, but without an increased fracture risk, or they have osteoporosis, which means by definition, higher fracture risk. So this T-score might have a minus 2.5 number, and that defines for us osteoporosis, which means high fracture risk. If the T-score is less than minus 2.5, it's called osteopenia. But I also want to point out to your listening audience and also our physician colleagues is that there's a substantial number of individuals with osteopenia who also have an elevated risk for fracture. And there's an additional tool with the DEXA we call now the FRAX, F-R-A-X. And we do this special calculation was developed, this mathematical tool, and we can define for such individuals with osteopenia that they may be in that group of osteopenic patients who also have a high fracture risk. And therefore, in my practice, I treat people with osteoporosis with medication to reduce fracture risk. And, Joe, I take the osteopenic patients with this high FRAX tool showing a high fracture risk. I treat them as if they have osteoporosis as well. Now, we're very fortunate, Joe, that we...
So, Mark, wasn't that FRAX developed out in England or something like that?
Yes, it was. Correct.
And that's developed got a fantastic there and benefit.
It is, and it's very easy. We just have to have Mr. Google just Google FRAX. It has the whole paradigm there of how we can use different information that is required. We put it in the patient's weight. They put whether they're smoking, whether they have excessive alcohol intake, whether they've had history of steroids, a family history of fracture, or personal history of fracture. There are a lot of different elements that go into this calculation, this mathematical tool, and that tells us right away. So if this person has a 10-year risk for fracture over 20% or a 10-year risk of a hip fracture over 3%, that tells us this person is deserving of treatment as if they would have osteoporosis. And
so
we can save a lot of potential fractures and disability from people by recognizing this in our patients and treating them preventively before the fracture occurs.
So, Mark, can you tell us what osteoporosis is versus osteopenia?
It, well, it becomes a matter of definition. And as like I said, the osteoporosis has a T-score. That is, they have a much larger differential between their bone density versus the normal population. So the bone mineral density is much greater differential. But also very important, which we don't see with the DEXA testing, is that not only is their bone density much lower, but also the pathology of the bone. So we did a bone biopsy, but we also see that the bony architecture is very abnormal. So I give the example to my patient. We see a building being built. We see all the framework there. We see whether it's a residential building with the wood studs or a commercial building with the iron with the steel studs there. We know that if we saw breaks in those studs, we saw a broken one, we would tell that building, hey, I don't want that in my structure here. And that's the same thing that happens with us. All these struts, all the framework that makes up our bony strength, our bony architecture. There are abnormalities there. The what we call the lattice structure, that is all the intricacies of connections here that gives bone its strength. It might be thin, it might be already cracks in it, and that makes the bone much weaker and much less stable, and that makes it much more friable and more fragile and more at risk for fracture. Now, unfortunately, there's not a good way to measure that architecture other than doing a bone biopsy. But Joe, if I offer bone biopsy to my patient, I'll probably have no patients left because they would make a beat line right for the door.
So the only, well, so the not only, that bad.
The only
I
other thing we
you.
Can do is the DEXA. So we do the DEXA, which is our best correlate, our best surrogate for the bone strength that we have. So we use that, which measures the bone mineral density. So it's the best surrogate tool that we have to see if the person does have a likely diagnosis of osteoporosis or the osteopenia, and then with the FRAX calculation to see if that person has a higher risk for fracture as well. But fortunately, Joe, we have a whole list of medication which can help these people.
That's what I want you to get to because we have about 5 minutes left. Can you tell us how you treat osteopenia and osteoporosis?
Yes. So in those persons that are deserving of treatment in the situation that I just described, we have anti-resorptive medicine. That is medicines which help to reduce bone loss because there's an imbalance here. The osteoblasts, which are cells that improve bone formation, and osteoclasts, which are cells that destroy bone, are out of balance. So unlike most things which are in balance, then there's no net change. But here, the osteoclasts or bone resorptive bone destroying cells far outweigh the bone former, the osteoblast. So we give medication to reduce the activity of these bone destroying cells. And Fosamax, Actonel, Boniver are examples of these medicines which can reduce bone resorption. But then very importantly, Joe, we have to remember that sometimes these medicines can cause esophagitis, gastritis, and may make it hard to tolerate. But we have some intravenously administered such medicines like Boniva and Reclass, which can also help the patient tolerate them and just bypass in the stomach to make it more tolerable. But also very importantly, Joe, we have drugs which can increase bone formation, drugs such as Forteo, Timlos, and these actually help to promote the osteoblasts, the bone formers. And these are the actual only drugs which can increase bone formation. They don't work by reducing bone loss. They work by increasing bone formation to improve your bone density, improve the structure of the bones, and reduce the risk of fractures. And then finally, we have the newest drug list is a drug called Evenity, or the generic name romosozumab, which is too much of a tongue twister to say, so we'll call it Evenity. And this is a fabulous drug because it increases bone formation. It works differently from the other two drugs, the Forteo and the Timlos that I mentioned. And it also has an effect on reducing bone loss. So it has a two-part effect, mostly on bone formation, but also on reducing bone loss. Now, on this particular drug, however, we have to be careful. If anyone's had any cardiovascular events within the past 12 months, then this drug would be contraindicated. We should not give this drug to them because that can increase the risk of some cardiovascular event if that is the case. But if they're otherwise in stable cardiovascular condition with no events within the past 12 months, then it's reasonable to give this drug, but it can only be given for up to 1 year. And the Forteo and the Timlos bone formers can also be given for only up to 2 years. And that's all they're FDA approved because of risk of side effects.
So, Mark, I guess the one thing is that there's been a history of everybody using anti-resorptives like Fosamax and whatever. But there's also now a push to try and get in the anabolics, these fancy drugs that can be used ahead of time. And apparently the results are better. And anything on your experience on that? Use the ones that build the bone and then go in with the anti-resorptives on second round.
That's correct, Joe. So if someone needs long-term therapy, which osteoporosis does, we would treat if they have severe osteoporosis and history of fractures. Then we would use these bone formers like the Forteo, Timlos, or Evenity. And it's always important to give the bone formers first. Then after we finish completion of the treatment with these drugs, then we would add the anti-resorptive, because if you give the anti-resorptive medicine like Fosamax, Actonel first, then the bone formation drugs are not as effective. And the persons requiring the bone formers would be the ones with severe bone loss and history of fractures. My first
Mark, you have
line
to give everybody
is not all
run out
that
of time.
One.
Mark, tell us everybody how they can get in touch with you. You're fantastic.
Oh, thank you, Joe. It's my pleasure to be here. You can always call the office at 856-547-8004. I do have my website, www.markfishermd.com, and I'll be very happy to help anyone that we can. And thank you for the opportunity of being here, Joe. I appreciate it.
Mark, you're fantastic. Thank you for your presentation. Always tip-top. We'll be back next week, Inside Medicine. If you want to check out Mark's podcast, www.wwdbam.com. Look for podcast, and Mark will be there in 20 minutes. Thanks a lot. Joe Fallon signing off. See you guys next week.